Good morning. Thank you all for joining us. If you could please get to your seats, we're going to begin. Thank you all for coming this morning to hear our guest, distinguished guest William Steiger. I'll introduce Bill in a moment. I'm Steve Morrison from CSIS here at the Center for Global Health Policy. Part of our work here, a very important part of our work, is having a regular stream of diverse, prominent figures involved in different dimensions of U.S. global health policy and other dimensions, be it international organizations, U.N. agencies, and the like. And it's been our assumption that this is just a very important piece to try and stir the discourse here in Washington, inform people, and have a very active dialogue of that kind. And we've been attempting in this period at the end of the Bush era and the advent of the next administration to persuade some of the key policymakers to reflect on their experiences in these last several years and to come here and share those experiences with us. And so Bill kindly agreed to that request. He will be focusing his remarks on the relationship over the last several years with WHO and with the Global Fund, among other agencies. I just want to bring forward a few other related important speaking events that are on our schedule and hope that you'll be able to join us at these as well. Pamela Barnes, President and CEO of the Elizabeth Glaser Pediatric AIDS Foundation, will be here tomorrow, January 13th, tomorrow at 11 a.m., predominant focus of her talk will be mother-to-child transmission, bringing that to scale, and the experiences that they have had over the last several years in massive startup of programs in Africa and elsewhere, and what she sees as some of the key sort of strategic obstacles that she believes could be overcome. On Tuesday, January 27th, at 3 p.m., former HHS Secretary Tommy Thompson, currently now the ambassador and liaison for the Global Neglected Tropical Disease Network, will be here to speak about that work on global neglected tropical disease that he has undertaken. So please join us. That's the 27th of January at 3 p.m. And then on February 5th, which is a Thursday, at 3 p.m., Ward Cates, a distinguished career official from CDC who over the last several years has been president and leader of FHI and the Research Triangle. He'll speak at 3 p.m. on February 5th about reframing the debate around reproductive health, a very complex, difficult subject, and he kindly agreed to come and do that. Bill will speak for 20 or 25 minutes, deliver his prepared remarks, and then we will move after that to a period of question and answer. I want to especially thank my colleague Suzanne Brundage for pulling all of this together. Bill has had a remarkable longevity in being in this position that he occupies as the Director of the Office of Global Health Affairs and Special Assistant to the Secretary of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services since 2001. And I think, you know, it is very important to emphasize that for a position that has become as important as this position has become in the last several years, as the international agenda around global health has expanded and as HHS and the Secretary's office has been called upon to be more activist, more informed, and to use U.S. influence and leverage to greater effect, the seat that Bill occupies has become central to all of that. And it is quite amazing that there has been such continuity in his role in that. He advises the Secretary and the Deputy Secretary on global health, international family and social affairs issues, and policy development in the U.S. government interagency process. And in his role, he represents the Secretary and, by implication, the U.S. government at various multilateral organizations or for major U.S. global initiatives. And this means serving as a member of the Executive Board of the World Health Organization, President of the Executive Committee of PAHO, member of the Board of Directors of the Global Fund to fight AIDS, tuberculosis, and malaria. Quite a large and ample set of responsibilities, and in a historic period in which all of those organizations have faced new challenges and difficult policy choices, and in which the U.S. position has been absolutely integral to moving things forward. Prior to taking this job on, Dr. Steiger served as the education policy advisor for then-Governor of Wisconsin, Tommy Thompson. He has lived and worked in Africa, Asia, and Latin America. He earned a Ph.D. in Latin American history at UCLA and a B.A. in history from Yale. Please join me in welcoming Bill Steiger here to CSIS.
Thank you, Stephen, for that introduction, and thank you very much for welcoming me here and for all of you who braved the weather and the traffic this morning. I really appreciate your being here this morning to hear whatever small pearls of wisdom I might be able to bestow on you. There are a lot of people in this audience who know more about these two subjects than I do, so maybe I'll be asking some questions of you rather than the other way around when I'm done up here. It's a good week for me to be here. This is my last 5 days of federal service. Contrary to the rumors that you might have heard, I am not burrowing into the bureaucracy at HHS. I am walking out the door at 6 o'clock on Friday, and I was up late last night, Steve, watching Office Space, the movie on cable. It was on HBO. And I feel very much this morning like Ron Livingston in that great moment where he's been to the hypnotist and he has that moment of zen and he tells his girlfriend, "I just don't think I'm going to come in anymore." So Friday afternoon, I'm gone. But in... Before I do, I appreciated the opportunity to share some thoughts with all of you on these two important multilateral institutions and to take some questions, and I'm happy to take questions on these subjects or anything else when I'm done. I was going to structure it this way, Steve, if that's okay. I was going to talk a little bit about each institution in turn, give some analysis of where I think things stand and what the U.S. position has been towards the two institutions, and in each case offer some thoughts on six or seven particular challenges that these institutions face in the next couple of years. And I'll end by offering some recommendations to the next administration, following very much on what Secretary Leavitt said in his remarks when he was here just a few weeks ago. So I'll start with the World Health Organization. At the outset, let me be clear that the United States and the Bush administration remain great supporters of the World Health Organization, and I think the record demonstrates that since the beginning. While the organization has many flaws, and we'll talk about some of them here today, there's no doubt that since 1948 we are all better off, we are healthier and safer because of the work that the WHO has done around the world than if that organization had never existed. And if we didn't have one, we would have to invent the WHO. Perhaps we could reinvent it in a slightly more efficient manner in some ways, but we would have to have something like a multilateral World Health Organization. Now, we remain here in the United States, you remain as taxpayers, the largest single contributor to both the extra-budgetary, the voluntary side, and the mandatory or assessed side of the House in terms of contributions to the WHO. 22% is our fixed quota percentage of mandatory contributions, which equals this biennium, 2008 and 2009, just a touch more than $200 million. In addition, just in this year alone, in voluntary contributions, between we at HHS, the U.S. Agency for International Development, the Environmental Protection Agency, and the State Department, you are giving almost $100 million, about 90 and change, in voluntary contributions. So almost equal to the mandatory contributions, we are then over and above that, because we believe in the organization, giving almost as much. Much of that almost $100 million in voluntary is going towards polio and measles eradication around the world. But there are lots of other things that we fund the WHO to do. Now, the Director General, I think, is one of the outstanding leaders, not just in global health, but in global politics today. Margaret Chan of Hong Kong, People's Republic of China, has been a very effective Director General. We supported her during her campaign and continue to think that she's got many of the skills to make WHO even better than it is today. She's been smart in focusing, at least in her public statements, on several key core areas of work. She said, and I'll get into this in a second, and how that matches up with some of these challenges, but she said she wishes her tenure to be judged on the organization's performance in Africa and on behalf of women. And in addition, she's pointed to two other critical areas as being the highest priorities of the organization: pandemic influenza preparedness and, related, the implementation of the revised international health regulations. She's organized the Secretariat in a smart manner, in our view, to take the bureaucracy to again, put emphasis on those issues. Her clusters and her, therefore, the areas of her work are organized in the following way, as she put them last year: health development, health security, health systems capacity, evidence and information, partnership, and performance. And what I'll go through today is some of the challenges that stand in the way of making the Director General successful in some of those areas. There's no question that despite its successes, and I think you can point to the smallpox eradication campaign, to polio, to measles, to a number of other areas, there are some structural flaws that neither she nor anyone are going to be able to change in the immediate future in the way the WHO works. This is an organization, unlike any other in the United Nations system, that was born with one serious congenital birth defect, and that is the regional structure, in which six regional directors are independently elected, have their own constituencies, and now, in the way the budgeting is done, have the lion's share of funding at their disposal. It is an almost impossible task for a director general to manage that organization competently without an extraordinary set of political skills. Now, we think Margaret has those skills, but nevertheless, the fact that she has six completely autonomous chieftains or fiefdoms to deal with makes her life very difficult and makes it very difficult for her to translate those aspirations for success and for focus into reality at the country level. It's also true that because of this, this political structure at the WHO, the organization as a whole is very circumspect about taking on member states. That is, ever telling a health minister that he or she has a bad idea, or ever denying a health minister's appeal for something. And this reluctance to challenge member states and to be very deferential to the member states also makes it difficult for the organization to focus on the bigger picture, those items or priorities which are objectively identified in the world of public health as the things that the organization ought to be doing. So there's an enormous political element to the life of the WHO that is not exactly the case, or to the same degree the case, in many of the other UN organizations, although the UN, of course, is a political institution as a whole. Now, the resources that she has at her disposal, the Director General, are also more limited than one might think. The entire organization's budget is on the order on the assessed contribution side of about $2 billion, well, just over $1 billion for the biennium, and then there is an extra budgetary contribution which exceeds that, at least according to the budget projections, but those projections are almost never fulfilled. So she has on the order of $2 to $2.5 billion to work with over the course of any given two-year period, which, with all of the challenges of global health, is not an unlimited sum of money, obviously. The President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, for example, will disperse on the order of $3.5 to $4 billion this year, actually more than that, more like $5 billion this year alone. So this gives you a sense of perspective about what the financial limitations are for the WHO. Nevertheless, there's an awful lot of good work going on there, and I just wanted to identify for you six key challenges that we think the Director General needs to focus on and is focused on in the course of the next 2 years, given some of these structural and financial limitations. One does relate to what the Director General has already said she wants to do, which is prioritizing focus. We member states and she need to do an even better job in the coming years of matching the resources, especially in that assessed contribution that she has at her disposal directly, on the core issues that the Director General has identified. She ran a campaign in which she said she wasn't afraid to prioritize. We believe that that's the case. She's done a good job of it so far, at least rhetorically, and made some structural moves in that direction. But it is the case that if you look at the distribution of the budget proposed for this next biennium against those four or five high-priority areas that she's identified as wanting to be the focus of the organization, the numbers just don't match up. One good example is pandemic influenza preparedness, where, in our view, the Secretariat itself is not allocating enough resources to that area. And while it's true that a large share of the money that goes out the door to the regions and the countries is going to Africa, the performance assessment for the last biennium of the WHO will show you that some of the lowest performing programs are actually those that are happening on the African continent. It's furthermore the case that the WHO does a lot of other things that really aren't that important anymore, or arguably someone else could be doing, and the organization could use an exercise of sunsetting or diminishing programs that are no longer of highest priority. Almost nothing ever dies in the UN system. This is particularly true at the WHO. The second challenge, which flows from the first one, are the disequilibria in the budget, the imbalances in the budget. And there are two principal ones that are of concern to not just we here in the United States, but to most of the major donors. And there is a time now to help do something about that. One is the imbalance between the regular or assessed budget and the voluntary contributions. The assessed budget has been relatively flat for so long, going on more than a decade now, that donors, both public and private, have been able to put their money most of the time instead into voluntary contributions. Now, a lot of the time, this is a dynamic between ministries of health and ministries of finance, or ministries of development and ministries of finance in major donor governments. The Ministry of Finance wants to keep the contribution flat, and generally speaking with ministries of foreign affairs, places like here and in London and Stockholm and Bonn, or Berlin now, have a policy of zero nominal growth at the UN organizations. That is, the assessed contribution should remain flat and only go up along with the rate of inflation. Now, the other development ministries, in a time when there's a lot more money around in assistance for global health, have found ways to still give money to the WHO just outside of that assessed channel. This creates both a practical and a governance challenge for the organization. Practically, it means that WHO operates much like many large universities do, in which the heads of programs become like deans of academic programs here in the United States, and they end up doing most of their fundraising themselves. Now, that means that donors are, in effect, accountable to lower-level staff and not to the director general a lot of the time, and much of the money that flows into the organization is beyond the reach, in the practical sense, of the director general herself, and it is hard for her to channel resources to her priorities because her staff has gone around the system to raise money for its own priorities. The other consequence of this for member states from the governance perspective in the UN system is that the executive board and the World Health Assembly also have very little to do and very little to say about this money that is coming from extra budgetary sources. It's not part of the decision-making of the formal governance structures of the organization. A third big challenge, which flows also from that, is the relationship with the private sector. WHO has always had a deep and abiding suspicion of all things private and corporate. This is not a surprise to any of you who have spent any time working with the WHO, especially if you're working on behalf of a private company. But it goes beyond just the very difficult relationship that WHO has had in forming any kind of dialogue with private, international, or local corporations in the food industry, the drug industry, the medical device industry, the alcohol industry. It goes well beyond that into a failure to recognize the importance of spending on health and actors in health that are not government employees. We're talking about non-governmental organizations, international and local, faith-based and community organizations. There is no seat at the table at the WHO for a non-government group most of the time. We're very pleased that there's actually an agenda item on the upcoming executive board meeting in January on private providers in health, put on the agenda at the request of the government of Thailand. This is the first time in my memory now, going back 8 years, that we've ever had a discussion like this at the board. And it is very difficult to have any conversation at the WHO about private provision of health. Almost all of the work that they do ignores the substantial contribution to the day-to-day delivery of healthcare in the developing world that private institutions do, either that people are paying for out of pocket or that people are seeking at charitable institutions often run by religious groups, but not exclusively. Another challenge that flows from that is that the WHO, being focused largely, at least at the headquarters level, on the rhetoric and the doctrine of global public health, has ignored, in my view, health providers themselves and the patient. And it's time for a reorientation of the organization towards the delivery of healthcare, not just the theory of population-based health. One of the things that WHO is often reluctant to do is to speak to the practice of medicine itself. This is reflected in the relative dearth of guidelines for practical providers on the ground, hands-on advice to people who are trying to solve the problems that WHO is committed to solving. Now, in my opinion, one of the best things that WHO does when it does is when it actually does put out very specific guidelines on treatment, for example, or on the standards of care. It just doesn't do it, in my opinion, often enough. It also probably doesn't do enough, in my opinion, on helping to build the regulatory and stewardship capacities of the ministries of health that are its clients. A lot of the budget, if you look at the categories, goes into health systems, much of which I think I have at least a hard time figuring out what that means and where that spending actually goes. One of the places it really ought to be going is to helping government institutions regulate the drugs that are in their marketplaces, help to figure out how to license physicians and other kinds of health providers appropriately, and work on the agenda of shifting tasks away from a very physician-centric, hospital-centric model to other layers of care. This is my own individual comment. One other aspect of this agenda for the WHO with the patient is that it's very difficult to see in WHO's work, especially its written work, the idea that all of us have some responsibility for our own health. This is an organization that, for the most part, in my view, takes the approach that health is something that is done to us by others. The latest example of this is the Commission on the Social Determinants of Health, in which, to my view, it's very difficult reading that report to come away with the conclusion that we all can do something about making ourselves healthier, either in the way we eat, the way we take care of ourselves, the way we seek health care in our own behaviors, or in the way that we can modify or mitigate our own risks to health. It's often seen as, in my view, at WHO, health is something driven by these immutable, faceless forces over which we have very little control. The fifth of my challenges I would identify is a very practical one that has to do with, I think, the very happy reality that in the next several years, the world will be free of polio. It has taken longer than we would like, but new developments, especially things funded, for example, in partnership with the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, like monovalent vaccines that are more effective, are leading us to the conclusion, I think, that polio is beatable and that the last four countries in India, Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Nigeria are going to get the job done in the next couple of years. But there's not enough thinking yet in the global community or at WHO headquarters about that post-polio world. What do I mean by that? Well, there are three basic questions, at least, that need answers. One is, what do we do with that marvelous system of surveillance and laboratories and volunteers and healthcare workers who have been mobilized for the past 15 years on polio and who now have begun to show their value in many other ways? A specific example was in Angola when Marburg broke out just a couple of years ago. The people who actually identified the first cases, isolated the first samples, started the first public health intervention were the polio eradication teams in that province of Ouija in northern Angola where Marburg first appeared. What do we do with those people, with those institutions? One of the great flaws of the smallpox eradication campaign, I think the public health professionals among you will admit, is that that network disappeared after the late 70s, and it's been very difficult to rebuild that in many places. Well, we have another opportunity not to do that again. A second challenge in post-polio is the system of vaccination. There are some hard choices coming about how to continue vaccinating for some period of time and with what vaccine. And there's not an international scientific consensus on this yet. Not even within my department is there a consensus on what to do. And the WHO has a leadership role to play in those recommendations. And finally, what to do with the thousands, perhaps millions, of samples of poliovirus that are still in freezers and laboratories around the world. After eradication, much like after smallpox, this becomes a threat to global health security. And the WHO and others have to make some decisions and recommendations about what to do with these samples. It's become relatively easy to genetically engineer or to modify in a laboratory the poliovirus in a way that's probably not going to kill millions of people, but certainly could sow terror after eradication. It's a scary thing, and it's not that difficult to manipulate. The security of those samples will be a key issue in the next 5 years. Finally, and this will lead me into the transition with the Global Fund, a key challenge for the WHO is improving upon and expanding the relationship with the Global Fund and also dealing with the proliferation of other kinds of partnerships that the WHO Secretariat is now hosting. If you look at the least performing programs at WHO, according to the organization's own performance assessment in the last biennium, they are in the areas of AIDS, TB, and malaria, and as I suggested, mainly in Africa. This is where the Global Fund has its greatest strength. At some point, it is worth asking the question, what is the WHO's role in a world with a very strong Global Fund on these three diseases? And as I suggested before, I think there is a very strong normative role, but not an operational role for WHO. And that transition has yet really to take place in some ways. So getting it right with the Global Fund is something that we hope the Director General will do in the next couple of years. And the break from the WHO in terms of administrative services that is happening as of the 1st of January offers a great opportunity to do that, because both organizations lost a lot of momentum and it cost a lot of goodwill in the back and forth over wrangling on individual details of administration. It is healthier for both organizations that they are free of one another at the administrative level, but they have to be knitted back up at the program level pretty swiftly. Also, the Global Fund is only the largest and most high-profile of the various partnerships the WHO has agreed to host in the past 5 or 10 years. There are literally dozens of them. UNITAID is another one that's quite high-profile. Many of them, in our opinion, in the United States in the last couple of years, are a drain on the organization's resources. And it is not clear how these partnerships are benefiting WHO as opposed to benefiting someone else. Many of them are workarounds of some other UN institution or have come about because the notion is that no one else will host except the WHO. Many of them don't have that clear a basis for being connected administratively to WHO. Programmatically, yes, but the organization is spending an awful lot of time and money on managing other institutions that are not in its governance structure, that are not subject to the Director General's direct control, and that, as I say, can often be a distraction. So let's turn to the Global Fund and the same sort of analysis and challenges. I was going through my notes yesterday as I was helping to start clean out my office, and I found my binders from the those of you who've been to my office know why I was in yesterday. I found the original binders, and Judith and Todd and some others will remember these discussions from the technical working group discussions in Geneva and Brussels in the summer and fall of 2001. No, those I'm keeping. Absolutely. They're books to be written by somebody in those binders. And I also went back to the speech that President Bush made in the Rose Garden on the 11th of May of 2001. Some of you were there. That launched the Global Fund and that announced the idea of this organization in a concrete way and set out a series of parameters that the United States would support in exchange for our contribution. I'll run through those right now, and I'll indicate to you, I hope I'm convincing, that in fact the Global Fund is the organization that the President wanted it to be in May of 2001 to a very great extent. And the lines on the page are remarkably thin. This was a relatively short speech. He went through 5 principles, and there's a 6th one that was a bottom line for us in the negotiations. And every one of those 6 is now a core part of the Global Fund's work and set it apart in a very positive way from what everything that had come before it. The first was that it should be a public-private partnership at every level. This is true. It really is the only international organization that one can say this about. The inclusive governance structure from the board to the technical review panel, to the secretariat, to the country coordinating mechanisms on the ground is unique and has no parallel. It's been my opinion but I'm saying it more publicly today, that in fact one of the great benefits of the Global Fund that goes unrecognized is that in many countries in the world it functions as a democratization program. The experience of putting together a CCM, according to the now much more rigorous criteria that the fund has demanded, has brought civil society and government together in many places in ways that were not possible before. And it also has encouraged government-to-government coordination among ministries that was not possible or was not happening before. The intersectoral nature, public-private, of those CCMs is one of the great strengths of the fund. The President called for an integrated approach of prevention, treatment, and care, and for the training of medical personnel. That's the hallmark of the fund's work, without question. And it's interesting when people talk about health systems and the Global Fund, that from the very beginning, the president had in his remarks that this was to be an institution that was to do work on health systems, read training of medical personnel, but focused on the three biggest killers. And it's our belief that the fund is doing just that. These diagonal benefits, if you will, as some people call them, of the fund's more vertical spending on the three diseases, are relieving a great burden on healthcare systems, along with the president's malaria initiative and the president's emergency plan, that are now allowing for the first time developing country governments to worry about the rest of healthcare. Now, who pays for all of that and how we do that is to a certain extent an open question, but there's no dispute, I don't think, in most of the places the fund is working, especially in places it's working well with the U.S. government programs, that hospital admissions are down, the crowding is out of the system, healthcare workers have time to train and breathe and do what they want, which is to take care of patients and to think about providing healthcare to other places. It's also to other kinds of patients. It's also true that the innovative things that the fund has supported in many places, like the Mutuelles in Rwanda, the healthcare insurance system, really are groundbreaking and are well beyond what is sometimes the typical perception that the fund only does things that are directly on one of the three diseases. Third, the president said we want to concentrate on programs that work and that this needed to be a performance-based funding model. I don't think there's any question that that's not the case. The fund has taken a tough stand in many places, and we applaud the board and the secretariat for it. It's the only program I know of in international health that does say no. Doesn't say no a lot, but when it needs to, it does say no, either on the basis of performance or malfeasance. Fourth, the president said we want rigorous scientific and technical review of all proposals, and that's the case. We think the TRP is probably the single most important institution in the fund architecture, and by and large has done a superb job under the leadership of Michel Kazakhstin when he was there first and now a number of other people. And we, as many of you know, based on U.S. law, have done a shadow parallel technical review of proposals since the beginning, and it is very rare that our own experts inside the U.S. government, along with our missions and embassies on the ground, find fault with the recommendations that the fund TRP makes. Fifth, the president called for the fund to respect intellectual property. And by and large, the procurement policies and purchasing policies that the fund has put in place have recognized the value of innovation and have not distorted the marketplace for drugs around the world. In fact, to the contrary, probably have created an entire marketplace that didn't exist before. And brand name companies are playing in that space. Now, the sixth one, which is not in the text of the president's speech, but was very much on his mind and on the mind of the negotiators at the time from the United States, was that we needed the fund to be an independent institution, not part of the United Nations, not because we don't like the UN, but because the UN had not to that point demonstrated that it could efficiently take money like this, apply it rapidly enough to problems like this in a way that was going to be as inclusive and as technically rigorous as we had hoped the fund to be. So that transition is now finally complete, as I said, as of January 1st. So all of those things, to us, add up to a great record of success for the Global Fund. The fund is not in crisis, despite what you might have read or heard. It's in financially good straits. It had enough money to fund the largest round in its history just a couple of months ago, more than $2.7 billion over 2 years. And it's now up to a secretariat of almost 600 people, maybe more than, Judith, we had imagined at the time in Brussels, but it's nevertheless lean compared to many other organizations, maybe every other organization in international health, and has before it an opportunity, I think, to consolidate its operations, to take a breath, and to be prepared for another spurt of growth in a couple years' time. I am personally of the view that a pause in the Global Fund's growth is a good thing right now. The trajectory has been so steep and so fast, there is no model for this in international development. You look at the growth rates of some of the other newer, quote-unquote, newer institutions in the UN, like the UN Development Program, or even UNICEF, which goes back a while but took a long time to gain really a head of steam to get to its peak. These were far slower rates of growth, allowed them to develop personalities, institutional cultures, and ways of working with countries that just don't exist with the Global Fund yet. It's still a very young institution. So that provides a great opportunity for the fund to face these six or seven challenges in a very coherent and thoughtful way in the next couple of years. The first I've mentioned before is the transition away from the WHO Administrative Services Agreement. Now, this seems sort of nuts and bolts to many of you, but this move has so consumed staff time at the Secretariat necessarily that it has been a distraction from other things. And it's now a good thing that WHO and, as I say, the fund are separate. But there are still a number of things that yet have to be worked out, and getting them right will be extremely important. Things like the pension plan, which still requires approval by the UN General Assembly here this year. The contracting and procurement rules for the Secretariat. In some cases, the privileges and immunities of the staff, including taxation privileges. The fund is now probably, but necessarily, going to have to conclude agreements with a number of important governments, as it did with us, to confer immunities on staff from those countries and on the assets of the fund and the taxation of and the salaries of workers. But maybe the most important thing is that the transition gives an opportunity for the executive director to standardize his approach to staff and to standardize the staff's approach to the grants. One of the weaknesses of the fund's portfolio management has been an inconsistency in some ways of how individual portfolio managers are approaching the grant negotiation process and the management of the portfolio over time. Now is a good time, as Michelle has reorganized the Secretariat, to focus on those issues as well. The second key challenge is the division of labor with other institutions. I alluded to this when I talked about the WHO. There is the macro five-year evaluation of the fund from June of last year pointed out both the opportunities here and some of the barriers to getting this done. The WHO is only maybe the largest of these partnerships that the fund has to get right. UNAIDS is another key one. UNITAID is a third. It's been my opinion, and I think the opinion of most of us in the U.S. government, that really, if you're going to draw this up on paper, UNITAID should have been part of the fund, or the fund should be doing what UNITAID is doing. Now that they are separate institutions, we have to get them to work together better. But the five-year evaluation pointed out, and I love this quote, that this process is impeded by institutional inertia in other organizations and an established propensity to express agreement at the high level of principles but not to translate these into operational parameters. Now, to me, that sounds mostly of my day-to-day life in government, but it's particularly acute when you deal with international organizations. But in doing so, the fund should not lose its own characteristics, what makes it unique, what makes it most effective. It should resist pressures to become like everybody else or like things used to be before 2001. Among the things I think it needs to resist is the great pressure, especially from Northern Europe, to be participating all the time in pooled funding mechanisms. The fund shouldn't lose its focus on accountability merely out of lip service to what's called harmonization. And in this process with the other institutions, the fund and others need to take a systematic approach to technical assistance. This remains a gap for many recipients of grants. They don't know to whom to turn. They don't often know that they can spend money on technical assistance, and they often don't have a clear idea of what they need the assistance for. And while it's not the job of the Secretary to provide that assistance, it can be part of the job of the Secretary to help bring the assistance providers like us in the U.S. government together with others. Next is a focus in the next couple of years during this, let's say, transition phase or pause in the growth of the fund on subrecipients and on the quality of data. We have very good information about the fund and its work, probably better information than any other international organization can provide us, in some cases better information than we can provide in the U.S. government. The amount of transparency and the sharing of accurate data from the Secretariat of the Fund is a remarkable achievement and needs constant positive reinforcement because not everybody likes that, especially some of the recipients. But the subrecipients are now have most of the money, but they're not integrated as much as they should be enough into the systems of fiscal oversight and performance monitoring of the fund. And there is an opportunity and a risk coming in the next year when the fund starts accepting what are called national strategy applications that are large multi-sectoral applications that go well beyond what the fund has traditionally been accepting and have the opportunity for great harmonization and great synergies in the way the fund is investing its money, but also have the risk of being outside of the fund's accountability structures if not done properly. Another challenge, number four, is on procurement. I touched on this a little bit before, but the fund does not yet get great value for money out of its purchasing of drugs and other commodities. but other things too, vehicles you could put on this list. There has been a great resistance from national recipient governments to doing large-scale pooled or joint procurements. That has meant slowness in disbursement, slowness in expenditure, and inefficiencies in spending. If you look at the price comparisons that the fund publishes, there's a wide variation between what some countries are paying for the same drug. This is especially true in lower middle-income countries, Eastern Europe, Latin America. It's better in Africa, in part because there is more use of some larger international systems there. But we in the United States have a great opportunity with the President's Malaria Initiative and with PEPFAR through the Supply Chain Management Partnership to help the fund get better value for money out of its drugs. There's probably no better way to make the fund's dollar stretch further than to focus very intently on procurement in 2009 and 10. The next one, it's very much like the WHO, although slightly different, the relationship with the private sector. The fund has a better relationship with the private sector than any other international organization I'm aware of, in part because the private sector was built into the DNA of the organization from the beginning. There's a private sector seat on the board. There are private sector seats on CCMs. But we don't yet take full advantage of what the private sector could do for the fund and its recipients. As the TRP pointed out in its 2004 recommendations, still true today, there's so little of the contributions of the private sector recognized in individual grant applications. And that's not just about money. That's about what in logistics and systems and management and procurement the private sector could be doing on behalf of fund recipients and the organization itself. A couple more. One is beware of mission creep. And Todd is here, and he and I have gone back and forth over this. The AMFM, or the large new facility for the purchase of malaria drugs, and Admiral Zimmer is in the audience, and he and I have been on the same side on this one. We in the United States have grave doubts about the efficacy of this experiment, but we have agreed to go along with it in the next couple of years. And there will be a point in 2010 when the board needs to evaluate the success or failure of this experiment and find ways to better integrate it into the work of the fund as a whole. There are other things that other people would like the fund to do: water, education, sanitation, to turn it into a global health fund, essentially, which was one vision in 2000 that didn't become the vision that the fund is today. There are inherent dangers in expanding the mandate of this organization too much. People look at it as an easy pot of money. It's not meant, in my view, to solve every problem. It's meant to solve targeted problems in a way that has systemic benefits. Two last things, challenges for the fund. The conflict of interest potential for CCMs, or country coordinating mechanisms. We were dismayed that we didn't believe the Secretary did quite as good a job as we might have hoped in screening CCMs in this last round. I find it hard to believe that the CCM in North Korea is really a legitimate CCM, even if it is donors mostly composed of donors. That's a personal aside. But nevertheless, there are still problems in representation and conflict of interest, and especially the ability of civil society groups to get a seat and get a voice at CCM meetings and in the decision-making around what goes into a grant and in many countries. Dual-track financing, which is an innovation we think is a profound positive change in the fund's business model, will help this to a certain degree. And that is, for those of you who don't know the jargon, fund grants are now very strongly encouraged, although not required, to have money going to both government and private and non-public sector recipients in these grants, and that's a very positive development. Last on the fund, managing the portfolio. As I go out the door after my service of being on the board and having watched this organization for a long time, there are two main issues with the portfolio that worry me. One is an increasing concentration of the portfolio in a relatively small number of countries. It is now the case that almost 50% of the fund's total grant commitments are in 10 countries, most of them in sub-Saharan Africa, but not exclusively. Ethiopia is the largest single recipient, although Zimbabwe will move up this list if it gets as much money as the fund has potentially committed to it. Tanzania, People's Republic of China, India, Zambia, Russia still, although it's paying back its grants, Malawi, Rwanda, Nigeria, and the Democratic Republic of the Congo. All places that have a lot of problems and have had problems demonstrated in spending fund money. And this is the largest share of the portfolio. That's a long-term strategic problem for the fund. And I would argue that the board needs to engage in an exercise of rebalancing that portfolio over the next few years. It's particularly the case, in my own personal view, that the fund should no longer be investing in China or in Russia and potentially not in India, countries that now, because of economic growth, have resources at their disposal that they didn't have 8 years ago or 10 years ago. At the same time, it's true that CCMs continue to apply for money over and over and over again for the same things or for similar things because we let them. There are no rules about waiting for a while to reapply after you've already gotten a $200 million grant. In the meantime, there are smaller and poorer places or smaller and more forgotten places where a little bit of fund money could go a really long way, especially in malaria and TB. And we have consistently argued that even upper-middle-income countries should be eligible for fund resources as catalytic resources, places like Latin America, like parts of Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union, where the problems are not yet so severe, especially with HIV, but interventions today could prevent a much larger problem tomorrow. So what do we do about all this, Steve, to wrap up? What would I say to my successor if he were sitting in the audience or if he were with us, if he walked into my office tomorrow? Here are my recommendations, and I'll break them into WHO and the Global Fund. The first would be for the WHO to make some attempt, however quixotic, to address some of the flaws of that congenital birth defect on governance that I described with the regions. And a good one, which would be a strong stand for democratization that I know the new administration is in favor of, would be to push for reform of the election process of both the director general and the regional directors. All of these ballots are done in secret. There is an enormous amount of political and financial horse trading that goes on. I can tell you from the last election I witnessed in Manila for the Western Pacific that they can be dirty. And that serves the organization very poorly to have any shadow cast over the selection of its leadership, whether at the regional level or at headquarters. And of all countries, the United States ought to be willing to stand up and try and make that change. We should have done it before. The second is for the new administration to rethink this zero nominal growth budget policy at the WHO and maybe by extension at other places. We're only hurting ourselves. We've allowed the budget to escape from us as the largest donor. We are no longer really as relevant as we should be because so much of the organization's money is outside of the structures of the governance process and is really outside the control of the director general herself. And adding to the core budget would be a way to diminish the pressure and the desire to raise money on the other side. Along with that, however, the third thing is we need to do a much better job as a government, and I have tried and failed at this, in having a strategic vision for what our voluntary contributions really ought to be doing at the WHO. Right now, we, if the WHO acts like an academic institution where its deans raise money, we act like an academic institution that funds our peers in the same way. Our funding is about individual relationships between people and smaller parts of bigger departments like mine that don't often add up to much. There is no real strategic plan. I'd argue that the whoever the new director of foreign assistance is going to be, or perhaps the Secretary of Health and Human Services, since we have the lead relationship with WHO, ought to convene a process to get, over the next couple of years, a true strategic plan that would help our agencies put money in the places where it's really going to matter. By the same token, and this is sort of a subset of my last one, we need our own strategic plan for the post-polio world, for our money. It's about $110 million now between us at HHS and USAID that goes into polio. At some point, we don't need to spend that much money on polio, but we wouldn't want to see that appropriation go away. So what do we spend that on that is somehow really useful to help keep that polio network alive to do other things? That needs a strategic review. Two more for the WHO. We need to answer the push for the WHO to get into the business of managing intellectual property by demonstrating in our own bureaucracy that we can help the market work better. And to me, the best way to do that is to aggressively promote a very little-known change that Congress gave to the Food and Drug Administration inside HHS last year, which is something called the Priority Review Voucher. What this means essentially is that if you are a major drug company and you want to get a jump start on your competitors by having your new drug application move further up the list so that our reviewers will see it faster and act on it faster than otherwise, you can come in and promise that you're going to be developing or investing in cures or treatments for neglected tropical diseases, and there's a list of them. It's a very, very powerful incentive for big companies to get into the neglected tropical disease space, because every month that they have exclusivity for a blockbuster drug is literally hundreds of millions of dollars in value. These vouchers, by the way, can be traded and can be sold. There is going to be a marketplace in these vouchers, and we need to get ahead of that and promote it. Finally, last thing on WHO, Steve. The DG, and we love her dearly, does need, in our view, to get more aggressive on the implementation of the international health regulations. WHO loves all of her children equally, and they are all perfect, and they're all above average. But some of them are not very good actors, and some of them are not helping us in preserving global health security by withholding samples of influenza, for example, by withholding data. And the DG should call them out on it much more strongly than she has to this point. And we, the United States, should probably be more aggressive in calling some of them out on it. Now, on the fund, similar. I mentioned this already, but prioritizing our technical assistance in a more strategic way to fund grants would be an important step forward. We've made some improvements in the last couple of years. I think recipients like the aid they get from the United States, much of it nuts and bolts around governance. We need to do probably more on procurement, and we need to be picking the places that it's most important for our strategic interest to be helping global fund grants work, rather than just a passive process which has applications come in from all over the world. We do need to say yes to more of the more strategic places. We've made one change in the last year, which I think will be very positive, and that is we've allowed some of our technical assistance money to go out to our individual missions in the PEPFAR focus countries to hire somebody whose job it is to watch the global fund. And that leads me to my next recommendation, which is we have to do a better job in making sure that our field staff understand that the fund, both for malaria purposes, for AIDS purposes, for TB purposes, is part of the U.S. government program. It's not somebody else's deal. It's not somebody else's money. It's our money. It's your money. And it ought to be part of the measurable responsibilities of our staff in the field. Third would be focusing on the procurement and quality and efficacy of the drugs that the fund is purchasing. Just as I say, the Secretariat ought to be focused on procurement. We ought to, too, and we ought to be helping the fund and its recipients choose the best drugs possible for the lowest price. I'd say we need the fund programs to work as best as possible, as well as possible, with our own programs, and that Tim and Mark Dybul and others at USAID who fund health programs at the State Department need to have a strategic way to make all of our health investments work around the fund to help answer this question of what are better ways to have health systems benefits from the fund's investments. Second to last thing, this is somewhat self-serving, I admit, for my own department, but it's important that the U.S. government approach to the fund be a fully interagency one. The fund has benefited, in my view, not just because of me, but because of all of the expertise that HHS has brought to things like the Shadow Technical Review. And by having people like Bernard Nalen and others deeply involved in fund work, it would be a mistake to think that the fund now should really only be the responsibility of the Global AIDS Coordinator or someone at the Department of State. One last thing, policy coherence across the UN system. We still do not do a perfect job, and those of you who attend these board meetings know it, of making sure we're saying the same thing in the same way at the UN General Assembly in New York, at the UN AIDS governing body meetings, at the Global Fund, at the WHO, at UNICEF. There is not a way at this point in the U.S. government to ensure that the U.S. delegations on certain issues going to every UN governing body in the course of a year are all on the same page. And that creates dissonance that people will exploit when we understandably are not as coherent or clear as we could be in the messages that we're sending to our peers, especially donors, and to the organizations themselves. So a long list of stuff. There's plenty of work to do. But with that, thanks for the time, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, Bill. I'm going to ask just two quick questions and then turn to our audience for several others, and then we'll bundle that and come back.
Sure.
One is if you can comment on this agenda in the midst of a worsening American domestic economic crisis and a worsening global crisis, in which we're entering an unprecedented period of uncertainty and stress and insecurity, in which global equity issues, in which poverty, malnutrition become factors, in which a threat begins to emerge towards existing investments in programs and the like, and begs the question of what kind of strategy is going to be most effective at admitting these threats and these realities, and mobilizing an American leadership around a course of mitigating the impacts and making best choices in these unprecedented circumstances versus making harsh or rash choices that might make things worse. That's a huge issue, but it seems to me that is, for the incoming administration, in sorting through the inheritance that you've, you know, illuminated in looking at these two organizations, our relationship, that big overriding question is going to be fully upon them, and already is fully upon them, as they try to outline what their policy perspective is going to be in this period. The second is the question of reforming WHO. And the IOM report, the letter report that just came out, tracks very consistently with some of what you said. Increase the core assessment, demonstrate good faith and commitment to the core, try to initiate a review commission, try to initiate a multilateral process that would build consensus around the notion of changing the rules. Now, this has been tried 3 times before and failed. What is really the how would you argue today it's worth making that investment today, that circumstances may in fact be more favorable to getting the kind of changes that are needed, rather than the skeptics who would say we've done that before and here are the deep factors that played against us? So I put those two big things out. Let's ask for 2 or 3 other. Please identify yourselves. There are microphones. Please stand up, identify yourself, and offer a quick comment or question.
My name is Ann Lyon. I'm the director of Health Systems 2020, and I had the honor of working with Bill when I was at OGEC, and he was our board representative to the USG board representative, and it was a real pleasure working with
you,
Bill, and I'm going to miss having you in that leadership role.
Thank you very much.
I hope, so I have a thank you and a comment and a question, and it'll be quick. The thank you is on these very clear and analytical comments you've made today. I hope that you'll have the opportunity to publish them quickly. I think that the next administration does need to hear these, and they're very on target with the years that we all have, a number of our colleagues here in the audience, and so hope you'll do that.
Thank you.
The one comment is on your WHO analysis, when you mentioned that there's too much focus on health system strengthening and there should be more focus on human resources and on task shifting and on procurement systems. Some of us would say that the human resource component and the procurement systems are, in fact, health systems issues. So I just wanted to make that comment out loud. And then my question for you. I guess it was 6-8 weeks ago, Peter Piot was here with one of his final visits to this country in his position. He had the opportunity to make some comments about UNAIDS as well. And one of the final recommendations was that the areas of leadership and management have been woefully neglected in some of these global health initiatives. And when you talk about the underperforming grants or the underperforming work of WHO in Africa, as well as your key recommendation for the Global Fund in terms of technical assistance, it goes right. The technical assistance isn't an end in itself, obviously. It's around the lack of performance at the country level, which tends to be a lack of of leadership and management skills. So, question, what recommendation do you have for either or both WHO and Global Fund around strengthening leadership for program implementation?
Mm-hmm. Thank you. One more. Any other hands? Okay, right here, ma'am. Then we'll come back to you, Bill.
Sure.
I'm Dunyo Luwole. I'm director of Africa's Health in 2010. Maybe I should just say, prior to taking up this appointment, I worked with WHO for 10 and a half years. I want to thank you for the analysis. I think it's real. And I think the recommendations are very practical. Concerning the reform of WHO, as had been said by Steve, this has been carried out a couple of times. I do recall that one of the weak links in the chain was said to be the country offices. Mm-hmm. And that still remains a problem. But I get the impression from you that you think the problem is at the regional level. Well, how do you relate these two? Because when the assessment was done, I think it was like 6 years ago, it came out that the country offices are extremely weak, and WHO took steps to try as much as possible to reinforce the country offices through appointment of very technical leaders as representatives of WHO and to increase the number of technical staff providing mm-hmm. assistance to the countries, mm-hmm. which is where the operational level is. And I listened to you saying that WHO needs to move from just policy and standards to actual delivery or focus on standards that will guide care and service delivery. These are the people at country level who would operate this. Mm-hmm. So I'm really not sure where the difference between the weakness at the regional level and the country level lie, in your opinion.
Thanks, Bill.
Good. Any order you want me to take them? I'll take yours if that's all right. Good. Thank you all very much for that. Thanks, Steve. So the first question, if I'm going to boil it down to my shorthand, would be, how do we preserve these investments in this difficult climate? How do we justify that it's worth spending money on WHO or the Global Fund at a time when, let's say, Americans are losing health insurance or they're hurting with their houses? Well, I'll tell you what Secretary Leavitt is saying and what he's telling Secretary-designate Daschle, which is, you would be surprised at how much time we have found it takes, how much time we have to spend outside the United States to protect the health of the people inside the United States. We're in a unique position at HHS. We're not a foreign assistance agency by statute. We don't have foreign assistance money. And we're not in this business out of altruism. Our whole mandate through the Public Health Service Act, which governs us, is to protect the health of the American people. I wouldn't be in my job, and we wouldn't be involved in the WHO and the fund if we didn't believe that those investments of our money, as well as the large U.S. government money, your money, make a difference to us here at home. And that's, I think, the basic pitch in a tight budget environment, is that particularly on things like tuberculosis, even malaria and HIV, that if and the other things that WHO does, that if we're not investing upfront in frontline interventions, both bilateral and multilateral, that's going to come back to haunt us in the health of people here. Immigrants, refugees, travelers, diseases know no borders is the cliche, but it's really true. And we have come under severe criticism here at HHS for supposedly mismanaging a couple of high-profile cases, which turned out not to be as a big a deal as they could have been, of, say, drug-resistant tuberculosis in travelers. But that's a nightmare scenario that very much redounds to the fact that we're helping to manage, to the extent we can, those kind of problems by investing in international institutions that are working abroad. So to Secretary Leavitt, that's the essential pitch, is we have to be forward deployed, we have to be forward invested in order to safeguard health at home. I know that's still a tough argument when people are looking at the deficit, but it's true from our perspective. So, second question, why take on governance reform now for the WHO? And I could either answer your question more broadly about changing focus or specifically about changing some of the electoral procedures and some of the way the organization gets put together. Which one do you want me to go with?
Tell us what is an actual feasible strategy for moving that agenda forward, okay? If you imagine yourself in this position in an Obama administration or in a higher position as Secretary Daschle, and you're marketing the notion of it's achievable and here's the strategy. Here's what you got to do. You got to set aside X amount of time. You got to make X amount of investment in terms of dollars and people's times and energy, and you've got to have a strategy for forming up a global coalition that's not going to fall on the rocks of Doha or any of the other kind of familiar patterns in which a U.S. executed or initiated strategy would have a high probability of failure. So what would the strategy look like?
So two things, and I'll talk about governance narrowly and then about reform more generally. The governance opportunity, I think, is that you have within the next couple of years both a DG election and several regional elections that are coming. Mm-hmm. So now is the window of opportunity to change the rules of those elections and to be clear and transparent about that to the candidates up front. We've tried to do this in the past well into election cycles when no one had any interest in doing that because they were already gaming out the votes. I think you'll see, especially after this last experience in Manila, that most of the major donors and many of the major middle-income countries are ready for a switch. And it's going to take somebody to step out and promote that. But it can't just be a U.S. initiative. There's no question about that. And particularly in this region, in the Americas, where we'll have an open seat at PAHO in another couple of years, this is a series of elections in PAHO's history that have not been transparent. And it's, to me, a great opportunity to push that agenda at the same time that we have an interest in promoting the preservation of democracy across the region. Now, on the larger agenda of reform, I also think there is some appetite among the major donors of doing better coordination of investments at WHO. And we clearly hear it from recipients that, or partner countries, that they are bombarded by, and they throw the fund into this, conflicting or complicated messages and procedures from lots of international donors and people who are trying to be helpful. And getting WHO right and focused on the right things can be a big piece of answering those problematic questions from recipient countries. So I think, what does the strategy look like? The strategy, as always in these things, is a political strategy, and to a certain extent it's personality-based. Someone, like the Secretary of Health and Human Services, has to put his or her own political capital on the line, in this case his, along with going to his peers in some of the major donors, and that would include both development ministers and health ministers, because they both play in this space in Europe in a way that is more conflicted than here, but then finding leadership among developing country ministers to stand up and say the same thing. And that's an even more powerful voice. People like Minister Tedros in Ethiopia, people like the new South African health minister, where we have a golden opportunity, others who are respected among their peers, who have a clear vision, the Minister of Health of Guyana, who've taken this on in their own countries and forced coherence among donors and among international agencies at the country level, they're the people who have to speak then at the international level for change at headquarters. And they can be the ones with our support who can lead that kind of a reform effort, in my view. So it is an international coalition with specific, very powerful personalities. Now, that leads me to the question about the country offices, too. I'm going to skip Anne's and come back to that last. You're right, ma'am. I used, unfortunately, the shorthand of regional to refer to both the six regional headquarters and the country offices. I do put them in the same bucket, and I often associate them together because the country offices really most of the time report to the regions rather than Geneva for most purposes. And the regional director selects those representatives in country with the assent of the government. So I mentally put them in one bucket. And you're right. That is the major area for management reform, is the operation and the quality of the technical staff at the country level of WHO. Now, I don't want to suggest that the WHO staff are going to be delivering health programs themselves. That's for somebody else to do, but they really can be extremely influential in how governments and other institutions deliver care. And often, if they're sending the wrong signals, it really complicates our life and our major programs and the life of the Global Fund. When they're sending the right signals, when they're advocating for the right policies, when they're helping to demonstrate best practices, then you can achieve a lot. And again, Ethiopia is an example of where the major players in the system are all working in the right direction under the leadership of a very charismatic and visionary minister. So I think I was just using shorthand rather than being specific about the country offices. Now, about leadership and management, you're absolutely right. My advice would be that it is time to be more explicit, either in the grant applications and in the management of the portfolio at the portfolio manager level, that there is assistance available, that money can be spent on leadership and management, and that this is a key hole in or weak link in the chain. All of us know how thin health ministries are on the ground. There's often one or two, literally, people who are trying to handle a multi-dozen million dollar grant. And when that person is sick or out of the country or otherwise occupied, nothing, literally nothing moves. One of my worries on this is the phenomenon, Steve, of creating darlings of assistance or darlings in the world of HIV, TB, and malaria. Uganda and Rwanda are the two examples that come to mind, where once a country gets noticed for having done something really good, everybody wants to come look at it, everybody wants the person to come make speeches like this. Well, that takes the very people who've made the positive changes out of the loop for 6 months or a year as they globetrot, or they spend their time as tour guide. And there does have to be a very concerted effort to create more mid-level managers, district, provincial, and in ministries. And we at HHS are at fault in not, I'll admit, sufficiently hooking up our own programs with those of the State Department to find, select, and bring together those emerging leaders in health ministries in the places we care about. There really ought to be much more investment in some of the programs that we have on offer, like the public health management and leadership training at CDC, like the Epidemic Intelligence Service, some equivalent like that where we are systematically finding candidates to be the next generation of leaders in the countries in which we've made heavy investments. And we're not doing that to the degree that we ought to, and we ought to be looking to form a partnership with the fund to make that happen.
We're going to do one more round, so please get your hands up if you care to weigh in.
Tony Carroll of Manchester Trade. Bill, let me add to Anne's congratulations on a great, hard, and wonderful run that you've had. You mentioned about the list of countries maybe wanting to expand, and let me just offer the comment about a case like Zimbabwe. If the American the Congress and taxpayer finds that we're spending a lot of money in a state that's utterly failed and continues to, in effect, inflict its designs and upon its people in such a horrific manner, obviously we have a credibility issue there. And having said that, do you believe that there ought to be some sort of criteria or minimum standards that we ought to employ or try to engender within the organizations of sort of good standing or minimal standards?
We have a gentleman in the rear. Can I just add one quick comment on Zimbabwe? I mean, I think it's important to note in this instance that there's been very, very quiet and effective and concerted U.S. WHO collaboration on the ground inside Zimbabwe in the midst of this horrific cholera breakout and the collapse of the medical system. I mean, the Secretary General has very quietly put a sizable team in place. OFDA put a disaster assistance response team, a DART team in place. UNICEF, IOM, there's a consortium, and it's not succeeding yet, but I think it's a very, very good instance of both WHO and Washington seeing the gravity of what's at stake and quietly putting some very strong talent into the picture to try and avoid the worst possible outcomes. Sir.
Carl Stecker with Catholic Relief Services. Thank you, Bill, for your remarks. And you did mention faith-based organizations, but I'd like to bring up again a concern that we have and whether there's an ongoing role for the next administration around advocacy for faith-based organizations in the Global Fund. There's no other subsector of NGOs. While NGOs are currently getting about 50% of Global Fund awards, there's no other subsector like faith-based organizations that have the magnitude of infrastructure in health, provision of services, the number of personnel involved in it, and yet after round three, 5% of funding goes to a faith-based organization. And regrettably, after another evaluation after round seven, still only 5% of funding for Global Fund initiatives go to faith-based organizations. So the question is, what would be the ongoing role of the next administration in addressing that inequity in the Global Fund awarding to faith-based organizations? Thank you.
And Sam in the rear here. Right behind you there, Sam.
Samuel Denny Jones, HHS. You mentioned briefly for the Global Fund malfeasance, which the other word for it is the corruption that some has occurred in some of these countries. Do you think that there's enough machinery within the fund to detect and correct malfeasance?
Okay. Good. I'll work backwards then. Corruption is always a difficult subject with any of these foreign assistance programs. Those of you who work in the business know this. I have been pleased, and we in the administration have been pleased to see that the instances of out-and-out theft involved with the fund have been very few, maybe surprisingly few, compared to the size of the portfolio. and for the most part, as far as we can tell, identified fairly quickly and dealt with appropriately. I'm happy to say that the fund has canceled grants on the basis of suspicions of corruption, even going beyond, I think, what we might consider to be full investigations. At the hint of corruption in a place like Ukraine, the fund went in and cleaned it up, moved the money to another more credible organization. Now, so I'm pretty confident that large amounts of money are not being stolen out of Global Fund grants. There are other things going on, though, that happen below the surface that I'm not sure we fully realize. And this is why I say focus on the subrecipients. I don't think we always know. It's a different kind of corruption. How organizations get selected to participate in grants, it also goes to Carl's question. There have been instances of what you might call double dealing or self-dealing on CCMs where there has been steering of funding to one particular organization over another, and we know that there are relationships among all of the people that are involved. That's not out-and-out theft, but that's also not exactly the way the system's supposed to work, and it is harder to capture that. The local fund agent system that the fund has been very good at tracking the money. And as I say, we know more about where the money goes. In fact, sometimes to the fund's own public relations detriment, because we know when the fund's money doesn't move, than almost any other organization that I can think of. That's a really positive thing. What is not always clear is how the oversight is working at the country level. Many CCMs are weak. Non-government participants on CCMs don't always have the voice that they need to. But the Inspector General, the current one, is quite a strong man. We're very comfortable with him and confident in his abilities. And if you've read any of his reports, and I encourage you to do so on the fund website, this is a guy who knows what he's doing and is looking in the right places, and I think is in doing things in the best interest of the fund and in the best interest of we as taxpayers. But it does bear watching, especially at the subrecipient level over the next couple of years, because I can only answer your question partway in the affirmative that I don't think large-scale theft is going on, but in terms of how the relationships are put together for the grants, sometimes an open question. And I'll go back to the issue of procurement, where clearly better and more efficient procurement, especially using international mechanisms, is going to take the opportunity for corruption out of the hands of people who might otherwise see a pot of money that would be attractive to them for those purposes. On faith-based organizations, I will confess to a great deal of frustration with this. You and I have shared that in the past. I was in India with Secretary Leavitt in November, and, well, a little earlier than that. I take that back. It was at the Global Fund board meeting in November. And I sat with Mark Dybul and the chairman of the Catholic Conference of Bishops of India. So the entire Christian population of India is about 3% of the total. Yet, and there's a subset of that majority that is Catholic. And Catholic institutions provide well over 20% of health care to the population of almost a billion people. Now, this is a reality, perhaps not as extreme, but a reality reflected in the role that faith-based institutions play all over the developing world. There is no question, whatever the denomination, that a large percentage of people in many countries are receiving high-quality health care from non-government institutions associated with one faith or another. And that is not adequately reflected in the investments that the Global Fund makes. I would put that personally on the agenda for a board reexamination of the portfolio. If we're too concentrated in 10 countries, we're also too concentrated, in my view, in government hands. And breaking that dynamic is a challenge for the institution in the next 5 years. As I said, the dual-track financing is going to help in some places. There are going to be principal recipients nominated for almost every grant outside of the government sector. However, there are biases in many places still, we have to admit that, about the relationship between international money and faith-based institutions. This administration has been, as you know, a great supporter of bringing faith-based institutions into government programs, including these that we are talking about today. And that's not because we're trying to promote one religion over another, but we recognize the incredible and irreplaceable role at this point that these organizations are playing in delivering care. And recognizing that country by country, CCM by CCM is a hard task, but that's where it's probably got to happen, although a re-examination of the Global Fund portfolio at headquarters to recognize this in a more systematic way could help as well. Zimbabwe and other cases like this. And Peter's in the back. He's been through these. Peter Mamikos, who was with us for so long and did such a wonderful job, has been in the thick of this for a long time on a number of these cases. I would say this. The fund, to my view, has a better track record in standing up to regimes that are really bad actors than almost any other international institution, and has said no, flat no, to several countries that were eligible for grants. And we, to understand, we have never said in the U.S. government that Zimbabwe or North Korea or Burma is ineligible to apply for money. We have simply said those countries, the CCMs in those countries that apply have to play by the rules. And the fund has said no to several governments that refused to play by the rules. That is one of the hallmarks of the strength of the fund as a performance-based institution. So in the Zimbabwe case, for example, the grants, there has been a case there, as you know, of what is out-and-out theft of fund money, now at least partially paid back. I mean, I'd like to see some interest paid on that money, but nevertheless, it's back. But clearly, what we've said in writing to the executive director of the fund and what we said at the board meeting, and I'm certain that the next administration will take the same line, is any further progress on the grants awarded in principle to Zimbabwe is dependent upon the CCM agreeing, and by extension the government agreeing, to play by the rules that the fund has set down in terms of access to sites, in terms of funding of non-government institutions, and in terms of not playing with the currency float or manipulating the money in any other way. And if the regime and the partners in country can come to an agreement that would allow that funding to move forward on that basis, we should be supportive of helping out a desperate situation. But we shouldn't walk in naively and believe that simply because we've got a Global Fund logo or WHO or U.S. government logo that our money is sacred and no one is going to go after it in a place like that or Burma or North Korea or anywhere else. So the policies that the fund board has put in place, I think, are sound ones. And the fund board has been rigorous and courageous, I think, along with the Secretariat in applying them in cases like that.
Done?
Bill, what you've said, it's, you know, just thinking about the scope of what you said, which is very detailed, very lucid. It's also fundamentally a very optimistic set of stories that you're telling. It's, you haven't shied away from the tough challenges that are there. I'm particularly impressed by the positive things you're saying about the Global Fund and in this era and where we are right now. I do hope you will write this up after you've left government. And I do, you know, and if we can be helpful in working with you on that, we're more than happy to be an outlet for that. But I do think these stories need to be captured analytically, this phase, and you bring a very special perspective on that. So I hope you'll do that. Thank you so much for all the effort and thought you put into this presentation and for everything you've done in this long run of this rather remarkable period, and we wish you the best of luck. So please join me in thanking our students.